failures struck again in 1839, Parliament attempted to come to grips with the problem. After 5 more years of analysis and debate, Sir Robert Peel succeeded in passing a Banking Reform Act. It squarely faced the cause of England's booms and busts, an elastic money supply. What Peel's Bank Act of 1844 attempted to do was to limit the amount of money the banks could create to roughly the same as it would be if their banknotes were backed by gold or silver. It was a good try, but it ultimately failed because it fell short on 3 counts. 1. It was a political compromise and was not strict enough, allowing the banks to still create lending money out of nothing to the extent of £14 million. In other words, a fractional amount thought to be safe at the time. 2. The limitation applied only to paper currency issued by the bank. It did not apply to checkbook money, and that was then becoming the preferred form of exchange. Consequently, the so-called reform did not even apply to the area where the greatest amount of abuse was taking place. And 3. The basic concept was allowed to remain unchallenged, that man, in his infinite political wisdom, can determine what the money supply should be more effectively than an unmanaged system of gold or silver responding to the law of supply and demand. The roller coaster continues. Within 3 years of the reform, England faced another crisis, with still more bank failures and more losses to depositors. But when the Bank of England tottered on the edge of insolvency, once again the government intervened. In 1847, the bank was exempted from the legal reserve requirements of the Peel Act. Such is the rock-steady dependability of man-made limits to the money supply. Groseclose continues the story. 10 years later, in 1857, another crisis occurred due to excessive and unwise lending as a result of over-optimism regarding foreign trade prospects. The bank found itself in the same position as in 1847, and similar measures were taken. On this occasion, the bank was forced to use the authority to increase its fiduciary, debt-based money, issue beyond the limit imposed by the Bank Charter Act. Again, in 1866, the growth of banking without sufficient attention to liquidity and the use of bank credit to support a speculative craze prepared the way for a crash which was eventually precipitated by the failure of the famous house of Overend, Gurney and Company. The Act of 1844 was once more suspended. In 1890, the Bank of England once again faced crisis, again the result of widespread and excessive speculation in foreign securities, particularly American and Argentine. This time, it was the failure of Baring Brothers that precipitated the crash. The mechanism spreads to other countries. It is an incredible fact of history that in spite of the general and recurring failures of the Bank of England during these years, the central bank mechanism was so attractive to the political and monetary scientists that it became the model for all of Europe. The Bank of Prussia became the Reichsbank. Napoleon established the Banque de France. A few decades later, the concept became the venerated model for the Federal Reserve System. Who cares if the scheme is destructive? Here is the perfect tool for obtaining unlimited funding for politicians and endless profits for bankers. And best of all, the little people who pay the bills for both groups have practically no idea what is being done to them. Leaders of the Leninist bloc of countries are no exception. They have been the most outspoken critics of the banking system of Western countries. John Maynard Keynes writes, "Lenin is said to have declared that the best way to destroy the capitalist system was to debauch the currency. By a continuing process of inflation, governments can confiscate, secretly and unobserved, an important part of the wealth of their citizens. By this method, they not only confiscate, but they confiscate arbitrarily. And while the process impoverishes many, it actually enriches some. As the inflation proceeds and the real value of the currency fluctuates wildly and from month to month, All permanent relations between debtors and creditors, which form the ultimate foundation of capitalism, become so utterly disordered as to be almost meaningless, and the process of wealth-getting degenerates into a gamble and a lottery. Lenin was right. There is no subtler, no surer means of overturning the existing basis of society than to debauch the currency. The process engages all the hidden forces of economic law on the side of destruction, and does it in a manner which not one man in a million is able to diagnose. From this, we may reasonably assume that the Leninists, and their Fabian counterparts, are well informed on this phenomenon. Yet after all the words of wisdom have been written, wherever Leninists and their socialist counterparts come to power, they invariably form partnerships with banks and unleash all the hidden forces of inflation to plunder their own people. Summary. The business of banking began in Europe in the 14th century. Its function was to evaluate, exchange, and safeguard people's coins. In the beginning, there were notable examples of totally honest banks which operated with remarkable efficiency, considering the vast variety of coinage they handled. They also issued paper receipts which were so dependable they freely circulated as money and cheated no one in the process. But there was a great demand for more money and more loans, and the temptation soon caused the bankers to seek easier paths. They began lending out pieces of paper that said they were receipts, but which in fact were counterfeit. The public could not tell one from the other, and accepted both of them as money. From that point forward, the receipts in circulation exceeded the gold held in reserve, and the age of fractional reserve banking had dawned. This led immediately to what would become an almost unbroken record from then to the present, a record of inflation, booms and busts, suspension of payments, bank failures, repudiation of currencies, and recurring spasms of economic chaos. The Bank of England was formed in 1694 to institutionalize fractional reserve banking. As the world's first central bank, it introduced the concept of a partnership between bankers and politicians. The politicians would receive spendable money, created out of nothing by the bankers, without having to raise taxes. In return, the bankers would receive a commission on the transaction, deceptively called interest, which would continue in perpetuity. Since it all seemed to be wrapped up in the mysterious rituals of banking, which the common man was not expected to understand, there was practically no opposition to the scheme. The arrangement proved so profitable to the participants that it soon spread to many other countries in Europe and, eventually, to the United States. Chapter 10. The Mandrake Mechanism. The method by which the Federal Reserve creates money out of nothing. The concept of usury as the payment of interest on pretended loans. The true cause of the hidden tax called inflation. The way in which the Fed creates boom-bust cycles. In the 1940s, there was a comic strip character called Mandrake the Magician. His specialty was creating things out of nothing, and when appropriate, to make them disappear back into that same void. It is fitting, therefore, that the process to be described in this section should be named in his honor. In the previous chapters, we examined the technique developed by the political and monetary scientists to create money out of nothing for the purpose of lending. This is not an entirely accurate description because it implies that money is created first and then waits for someone to borrow it. On the other hand, textbooks on banking often state that money is created out of debt. This also is misleading because it implies that debt exists first and then is converted into money. In truth, money is not created until the instant it is borrowed. It is the act of borrowing which causes it to spring into existence. And incidentally, it is the act of paying off the debt that causes it to vanish. There is no short phrase that perfectly describes that process. So, until one is invented along the way, we shall continue using the phrase, create money out of nothing, and occasionally add, "for the purpose of lending," where necessary, to further clarify the meaning. So let us now leave the historical figures of the past and jump into their future, in other words, into our present, and see just how far this money-debt creation process has been carried, and how it works. The first fact that needs to be considered is that our money today has no gold or silver behind it whatsoever. The fraction is not 54%, nor 15%. It is 0%. It has traveled the path of all previous fractional money in history, and already has degenerated into pure fiat money. The fact that most of it is in the form of checkbook balances rather than paper currency is a mere technicality, and the fact that bankers speak about reserve ratios is eyewash. The so-called reserves to which they refer are, in fact, treasury bonds and other certificates of debt. Our money is pure fiat, through and through. The second fact that needs to be clearly understood is that, in spite of the technical jargon and seemingly complicated procedures, the actual mechanism by which the Federal Reserve creates money is quite simple. They do it exactly the same way the goldsmiths of old did, except, of course, the goldsmiths were limited by the need to hold some precious metal in reserve, whereas the Fed has no such restriction. The Federal Reserve is candid. The Federal Reserve itself is amazingly frank about this process. A booklet published by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York tells us, "Currency cannot be redeemed or exchanged for treasury gold or any other asset used as backing. The question of just what assets back Federal Reserve notes has little but bookkeeping significance." Elsewhere in the same publication, we are told, "Banks are creating money based on a borrower's promise to pay, the IOU. Banks create money by monetizing the private debts of businesses and individuals." In a booklet entitled Modern Money Mechanics, the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago says, "In the United States, neither paper currency nor deposits have value as commodities. Intrinsically, a dollar bill is just a piece of paper. Deposits are merely book entries. Coins do have some intrinsic value as metal, but generally far less than their face amount. What then makes these instruments, checks, paper money, and coins, acceptable at face value in payment of all debts and for other monetary uses? Mainly, it is the confidence people have that they will be able to exchange such money for other financial assets and real goods and services whenever they choose to do so. This partly is a matter of law. Currency has been designated legal tender by the government. That is, it must be accepted." In the fine print of a footnote in a bulletin of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, we find this surprisingly candid explanation. "Modern monetary systems have a fiat base, literally money by decree, with depository institutions acting as fiduciaries, creating obligations against themselves with the fiat base acting in part as reserves. The decree appears on the currency notes. This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. While no individual could refuse to accept such money for debt repayment, exchange contracts could easily be composed to thwart its use in everyday commerce. However, a forceful explanation as to why money is accepted is that the federal government requires it as payment for tax liabilities. Anticipation of the need to clear this debt creates a demand for the pure fiat dollar. Money would vanish without debt." It is difficult for Americans to come to grips with the fact that their total money supply is backed by nothing but debt, and it is even more mind-boggling to visualize that if everyone paid back all that was borrowed, there would be no money left in existence. That's right, there would be not one penny in circulation. All coins and all paper currency would be returned to bank vaults, and there would be not $1 in anyone's checking account. In short, all money would disappear. Mariner Eccles was the governor of the Federal Reserve System in 1941. On September 30th of that year, Eccles was asked to give testimony before the House Committee on Banking and Currency. The purpose of the hearing was to obtain information regarding the role of the Federal Reserve in creating conditions that led to the Depression of the 1930s. Congressman Wright Patman, who was chairman of that committee, asked how the Fed got the money to purchase $2 billion worth of government bonds in 1933. This is the exchange that followed. Eccles: "We created it." Patman: "Out of what?" Eccles: "Out of the right to issue credit money." Patman: "And there is nothing behind it, is there, except our government's credit?" Eccles: "That is what our money system is. If there were no debts in our money system, there wouldn't be any money." It must be realized that while money may represent an asset to selected individuals, when it is considered as an aggregate of the total money supply, it is not an asset at all. A man who borrows $1,000 may think that he has increased his financial position by that amount, but he has not. His $1,000 cash asset is offset by his $1,000 loan liability, and his net position is zero. Bank accounts are exactly the same on a larger scale. Add up all the bank accounts in the nation, and it would be easy to assume that all that money represents a gigantic pool of assets which support the economy. Yet every bit of this money is owed by someone. Some will owe nothing, others will owe many times what they possess. All added together, the national balance is zero. What we think is money is but a grand illusion. The reality is debt. Robert Hemphill was the credit manager of the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta. In the foreword to a book by Irving Fisher entitled 100% Money, Hemphill said this: "If all the bank loans were paid, no one could have a bank deposit, and there would not be a dollar of coin or currency in circulation." This is a staggering thought. We are completely dependent on the commercial banks. Someone has to borrow every dollar we have in circulation, cash or credit. If the banks create ample synthetic money, we are prosperous. If not, we starve. We are absolutely without a permanent money system. When one gets a complete grasp of the picture, the tragic absurdity of our hopeless situation is almost incredible. But there it is. With the knowledge that money in America is based on debt, it should not come as a surprise to learn that the Federal Reserve System is not the least interested in seeing a reduction in debt in this country, regardless of public utterances to the contrary. Here is the bottom line from the system's own publications. The Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia says, "A large and growing number of analysts, on the other hand, now regard the national debt as something useful, if not an actual blessing. They believe the national debt need not be reduced at all." The Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago adds, "Debt, public and private, is here to stay. It plays an essential role in economic processes. What is required is not the abolition of debt, but its prudent use and intelligent management." What's wrong with a little debt? There is a kind of fascinating appeal to this theory. It gives those who expound it an aura of intellectualism, the appearance of being able to grasp a complex economic principle that is beyond the comprehension of mere mortals. And, for the less academically minded, it offers the comfort of at least sounding moderate. After all, what's wrong with a little debt, prudently used and intelligently managed? The answer is nothing, provided the debt is based on an honest transaction. There is plenty wrong with it if it is based upon fraud. An honest transaction is one in which a borrower pays an agreed-upon sum in return for the temporary use of a lender's asset. That asset could be anything of tangible value. If it were an automobile, for example, then the borrower would pay rent. If it is money, then the rent is called interest. Either way, the concept is the same. When we go to a lender, either a bank or a private party, and receive a loan of money, we are willing to pay interest on the loan in recognition of the fact that the money we are borrowing is an asset which we want to use. It seems only fair to pay a rental fee for that asset to the person who owns it. It is not easy to acquire an automobile, and it is not easy to acquire money. Real money, that is. If the money we are borrowing was earned by someone's labor and talent, they are fully entitled to receive interest on it. But what are we to think of money that is created by the mere stroke of a pen or the click of a computer key? Why should anyone collect a rental fee on that? When banks place credits into your checking account, they are merely pretending to lend you money. In reality, they have nothing to lend. Even the money that non-indebted depositors have placed with them was originally created out of nothing in response to someone else's loan. So what entitles the banks to collect rent on nothing? It is immaterial that men everywhere are forced by law to accept these nothing certificates in exchange for real goods and services. We are talking here not about what is legal, but what is moral. As Thomas Jefferson observed at the time of his protracted battle against central banking in the United States, no one has a natural right to the trade of moneylender but he who has money to lend. Third reason to abolish the system. Centuries ago, usury was defined as any interest charged for a loan. Modern usage has redefined it as excessive interest. Certainly, any amount of interest charged for a pretended loan is excessive. The dictionary, therefore, needs a new definition: usury, the charging of any interest on a loan of fiat money. Let us, therefore, look at debt and interest in this light. Thomas Edison summed up the immorality of the system when he said, "People who will not turn a shovelful of dirt on the project, nor contribute a pound of materials, will collect more money than will the people who will supply all the materials and do all the work." Is that an exaggeration? Let us consider the purchase of a $100,000 home in which $30,000 represents the cost of the land, architect's fee, sales commissions, building permits, and that sort of thing, and $70,000 is the cost of labor and building materials. If the home buyer puts up $30,000 as a down payment, then $70,000 must be borrowed. If the loan is issued at 11% over a 30-year period, the amount of interest paid will be $167,806. That means the amount paid to those who lend the money is about 2.5 times greater than paid to those who provide all the labor and all the materials. It is true that this figure represents the time value of that money over 30 years and easily could be justified on the basis that a lender deserves to be compensated for surrendering the use of his capital for half a lifetime. But that assumes the lender actually had something to surrender, that he had earned the capital, saved it, and then lent it for construction of someone else's house. What are we to think, however, about a lender who did nothing to earn the money, had not saved it, and in fact simply created it out of thin air? What is the time value of nothing? As we have already shown, every dollar that exists today, either in the form of currency, checkbook money, or even credit card money, in other words, our entire money supply, exists only because it was borrowed by someone. Perhaps not you, but someone. That means all the American dollars in the entire world are earning daily and compounded interest for the banks which created them. A portion of every business venture, every investment, every profit, every transaction which involves money, and that even includes losses and the payment of taxes, a portion of all that is earmarked as payment to a bank. And what did the banks do to earn this perpetually flowing river of wealth? Did they lend out their own capital obtained through the investment of stockholders? Did they lend out the hard-earned savings of their depositors? No, neither of these was their major source of income. They simply waved the magic wand called fiat money. The flow of such unearned wealth under the guise of interest can only be viewed as usury of the highest magnitude. Even if there were no other reasons to abolish the Fed, the fact that it is the supreme instrument of usury would be more than sufficient by itself.
You have reached the end of Disc 7.
Who creates the money to pay the interest? One of the most perplexing questions associated with this process is, where does the money come from to pay the interest? If you borrow $10,000 from a bank at 9%, you owe $10,900. But the bank only manufactures $10,000 for the loan. It would seem, therefore, that there is no way that you, and all others with similar loans, can possibly pay off your indebtedness. The amount of money put into circulation just isn't enough to cover the total debt, including interest. This has led some to the conclusion that it is necessary for you to borrow the $900 for the interest, and that, in turn, leads to still more interest. The assumption is that the more we borrow, the more we have to borrow, and that debt based on fiat money is a never-ending spiral leading inexorably to more and more debt. This is a partial truth. It is true that there is not enough money created to include the interest, but it is a fallacy that the only way to pay it back is to borrow still more. The assumption fails to take into account the exchange value of labor. Let us assume that you pay back your $10,000 loan at the rate of approximately $900 per month, and that about $80 of that represents interest. You realize you are hard-pressed to make your payments, so you decide to take on a part-time job. The bank, on the other hand, is now making $80 profit each month on your loan. Since this amount is classified as interest, it is not extinguished, as is the larger portion, which is a return of the loan itself. So this remains as spendable money in the account of the bank. The decision then is made to have the bank's floors waxed once a week. You respond to the ad in the paper and are hired at $80 per month to do the job. The result is that you earn the money to pay the interest on your loan, and this is the point. The money you receive is the same money which you previously had paid. As long as you perform labor for the bank each month, the same dollars go into the bank as interest, then out the revolving door as your wages, and then back into the bank as loan repayment. It is not necessary that you work directly for the bank, no matter where you earn the money. Its origin was a bank, and its ultimate destination is a bank. The loop through which it travels can be large or small, but the fact remains all interest is paid eventually by human effort. And the significance of that fact is even more startling than the assumption that not enough money is created to pay back the interest. It is that the total of this human effort, ultimately, is for the benefit of those who create fiat money. It is a form of modern serfdom, in which the great mass of society works as indentured servants to a ruling class of financial nobility. Understanding the illusion. That's really all one needs to know about the operation of the banking cartel under the protection of the Federal Reserve. But it would be a shame to stop here without taking a look at the actual cogs, mirrors, and pulleys that make the magical mechanism work. It is a truly fascinating engine of mystery and deception. Let us therefore turn our attention to the actual process by which the magicians create the illusion of modern money. First, we shall stand back for a general view to see the overall action. Then we shall move in closer and examine each component in detail. The Mandrake Mechanism, an overview. The entire function of this machine is to convert debt into money. It's just that simple. First, the Fed takes all the government bonds, which the public does not buy, and writes a check to Congress in exchange for them. It acquires other debt obligations as well, but government bonds comprise most of its inventory. There is no money to back up this check. These fiat dollars are created on the spot for that purpose. By calling those bonds reserves, the Fed then uses them as the base for creating 9 additional dollars for every dollar created for the bonds themselves. The money created for the bonds is spent by the government, whereas the money created on top of those bonds is the source of all the bank loans made to the nation's businesses and individuals. The result of this process is the same as creating money on a printing press, but the illusion is based on an accounting trick rather than a printing trick. The bottom line is that Congress and the banking cartel have entered into a partnership in which the cartel has the privilege of collecting interest on money which it creates out of nothing, a perpetual override on every American dollar that exists in the world. Congress, on the other hand, has access to unlimited funding without having to tell the voters their taxes are being raised through the process of inflation. If you understand this, you understand the Federal Reserve System. Now for a more detailed view. There are 3 general ways in which the Federal Reserve creates fiat money out of debt. One is by making loans to the member banks through what is called the discount window. The second is by purchasing treasury bonds and other certificates of debt through what is called the Open Market Committee. The third is by changing the so-called reserve ratio that member banks are required to hold. Each method is merely a different path to the same objective, taking in IOUs and converting them into spendable money. The discount window. The discount window is merely bankers' language for the loan window. When banks run short of money, the Federal Reserve stands ready as the banker's bank to lend it. There are many reasons for them to need loans. Since they hold reserves of only about 1 or 2% of their deposits in vault cash and 8 or 9% in securities, their operating margin is extremely thin. It is common for them to experience temporary negative balances caused by unusual customer demand for cash or unusually large clusters of checks all clearing through other banks at the same time. Sometimes they make bad loans, and when these former assets are removed from their books, their reserves are also decreased and may, in fact, become negative. Finally, there is the profit motive. When banks borrow from the Federal Reserve at 1 interest rate and lend it out at a higher rate, there is an obvious advantage. But that is merely the beginning. When a bank borrows a dollar from the Fed, it becomes a $1 reserve. Since the banks are required to keep reserves of only about 10%, they actually can lend up to $9 for each dollar borrowed. Let's take a look at the math. Assume the bank receives $1 million from the Fed at a rate of 8%. The total annual cost, therefore, is $80,000, 0.08 times $1 million. The bank treats the loan as a cash deposit, which means it becomes the basis for manufacturing an additional $9 million to be lent to its customers. If we assume that it lends that money at 11% interest, its gross return would be $990,000, 0.11 times $9 million. Subtract this from the bank's cost of $80,000 plus an appropriate share of its overhead, and we have a net return of about $900,000. In other words, the bank borrows $1 million and can almost double it in 1 year. That's leverage. But don't forget the source of that leverage, the manufacture of another $9 million, which is added to the nation's money supply. The open market operation. The most important method used by the Federal Reserve for the creation of fiat money is the purchase and sale of securities on the open market. But before jumping into this, a word of warning. Don't expect what follows to make any sense. Just be prepared to know that this is how they do it. The trick lies in the use of words and phrases which have technical meanings quite different from what they imply to the average citizen. So keep your eye on the words. They are not meant to explain, but to deceive. In spite of first appearances, the process is not complicated. It is just absurd. The Mandrake Mechanism, a detailed view. Start with: the federal government adds ink to a piece of paper, creates impressive designs around the edges, and calls it a bond or treasury note. It is merely a promise to pay a specified sum at a specified interest on a specified date. As we shall see in the following steps, this debt eventually becomes the foundation for almost the entire nation's money supply. In reality, the government has created cash, but it doesn't yet look like cash. To convert these IOUs into paper bills and checkbook money is the function of the Federal Reserve System. To bring about that transformation, the bond is given to the Fed, where it is then classified as a securities asset. An instrument of government debt is considered an asset because it is assumed the government will keep its promise to pay. This is based upon its ability to obtain whatever money it needs through taxation. Thus, the strength of this asset is the power to take back that which it gives. So the Federal Reserve now has an asset which can be used to offset a liability. It then creates this liability by adding ink to yet another piece of paper and exchanging that with the government in return for the asset. That second piece of paper is a Federal Reserve check. There is no money in any account to cover this check. Anyone else doing that would be sent to prison. It is legal for the Fed, however, because Congress wants the money, and this is the easiest way to get it. To raise taxes would be political suicide. To depend on the public to buy all the bonds would not be realistic, especially if interest rates are set artificially low, and to print very large quantities of currency would be obvious and controversial. This way, the process is mysteriously wrapped up in the banking system. The end result, however, is the same as turning on government printing presses and simply manufacturing fiat money. Money created by the order of government with nothing of tangible value backing it, to pay government expenses. Yet in accounting terms, the books are said to be balanced because the liability of the money is offset by the asset of the IOU. The Federal Reserve check received by the government is then endorsed and sent back to one of the Federal Reserve banks, where it now becomes a government deposit. Once the Federal Reserve check has been deposited into the government's account, it is used to pay government expenses and thus is transformed into many government checks. These checks become the means by which the first wave of fiat money floods into the economy. Recipients now deposit them into their own bank accounts, where they become commercial bank deposits. Commercial bank deposits immediately take on a split personality. On the one hand, they are liabilities to the bank because they are owed back to the depositors. But as long as they remain in the bank, they also are considered as assets because they are on hand. Once again, the books are balanced. The assets offset the liabilities. But the process does not stop there. Through the magic of fractional reserve banking, the deposits are made to serve an additional and more lucrative purpose. To accomplish this, the on-hand deposits now become reclassified in the books and called bank reserves. Reserves for what? Are these for paying off depositors should they want to close out their accounts? No. That's the lowly function they served when they were classified as mere assets. Now that they have been given the name of reserves, they become the magic wand to materialize even larger amounts of fiat money. This is where the real action is, at the level of the commercial banks. Here's how it works. The banks are permitted by the Fed to hold as little as 10% of their deposits in reserve. That means if they receive deposits of $1 million from the first wave of fiat money created by the Fed, they have $900,000 more than they are required to keep on hand, $1 million less 10% reserve. In bankers' language, that $900,000 is called excess reserves. The word excess is a tip-off that these so-called reserves have a special destiny. Now that they have been transmuted into an excess, they are considered as available for lending. And so, in due course, these excess reserves are converted into bank loans. But wait a minute. How can this money be lent out when it is owned by the original depositors who are still free to write checks and spend it anytime they wish? Isn't that a double claim against the same money? The answer is that when the new loans are made, they are not made with the same money at all. They are made with brand new money created out of thin air for that purpose. The nation's money supply simply increases by 90% of the bank's deposits. Furthermore, this new money is far more interesting to the banks than the old. The old money, which they received from depositors, requires them to pay out interest or perform services for the privilege of using it. But with the new money, the banks collect interest instead, which is not too bad considering it cost them nothing to make. Nor is that the end of the process. When this second wave of fiat money moves into the economy, it comes right back into the banking system, just as the first wave did, in the form of more commercial bank deposits. The process now repeats, but with slightly smaller numbers each time around. What was a loan on Friday comes back into the bank as a deposit on Monday. The deposit then is reclassified as a reserve, and 90% of that becomes an excess reserve, which once again is available for a new loan. Thus, the $1 million of first wave fiat money gives birth to $900,000 in the second wave, and that gives birth to $810,000 in the third wave, $900,000 less 10% reserve. It takes about 28 times through the revolving door of deposits becoming loans, becoming deposits, becoming more loans, until the process plays itself out to the maximum effect, which is bank fiat money equals up to 9 times national debt. The amount of fiat money created by the banking cartel is approximately 9 times the amount of the original government debt, which made the entire process possible. When the original debt itself is added to that figure, we finally have total fiat money equals up to 10 times national debt. The total amount of fiat money that can be created by the Federal Reserve and the commercial banks together is approximately 10 times the amount of the underlying government debt. To the degree that this newly created money floods into the economy in excess of goods and services, it causes the purchasing power of all money, both old and new, to decline. Prices go up because the relative value of the money has gone down. The result is the same as if that purchasing power had been taken from us in taxes. The reality of this process, therefore, is that it is a hidden tax equaling up to 10 times the national debt. Without realizing it, Americans have paid over the years, in addition to their federal income taxes and excise taxes, a completely hidden tax equal to many times the national debt. And that still is not the end of the process. Since our money supply is purely an arbitrary entity with nothing behind it except debt, its quantity can go down as well as up. When people are going deeper into debt, the nation's money supply expands and prices go up. But when they pay off their debts and refuse to renew, the money supply contracts and prices tumble. That is exactly what happens in times of economic or political uncertainty. This alteration between periods of expansion and contraction of the money supply is the underlying cause of booms, busts, and depressions. Who benefits from all of this? Certainly not the average citizen. The only beneficiaries are the political scientists in Congress who enjoy the effect of unlimited revenue to perpetuate their power, and the monetary scientists within the banking cartel called the Federal Reserve System, who have been able to harness the American people, without their knowing it, to the yoke of modern feudalism. Reserve ratios. The previous figures are based on a reserve ratio of 10%, a money expansion ratio of 10 to 1. It must be remembered, however, that this is purely arbitrary. Since money is fiat, there is no real limitation except what the money managers decide is expedient. At any time there is a need for more money, the pretense of a reserve can be dropped altogether. There is virtually no limit to the amount of fiat money that can be manufactured under the present system. National debt not necessary for inflation. Because the Federal Reserve can be counted on to monetize, convert into money, virtually any amount of government debt, and because this process of expanding the money supply is the primary cause of inflation, it is tempting to jump to the conclusion that federal debt and inflation are but two aspects of the same phenomenon. This, however, is not necessarily true. It is quite possible to have either one without the other. The banking cartel holds a monopoly in the manufacture of money. Consequently, money is created only when IOUs are monetized by the Fed or by commercial banks. When private individuals, corporations, or institutions purchase government bonds, they must use money they have previously earned and saved. In other words, no new money is created because they are using funds that are already in existence. Therefore, the sale of government bonds to the banking system is inflationary, but when sold to the private sector, it is not. That is the primary reason the United States avoided massive inflation during the 1980s, when the federal government was going into debt at a greater rate than ever before in its history. By keeping interest rates high, these bonds became attractive to private investors, including those in other countries. Very little new money was created because most of the bonds were purchased with American dollars already in existence. This, of course, was a temporary fix at best. Today, those bonds are continually maturing and are being replaced by still more bonds to include the original debt plus accumulated interest. Eventually, this process must come to an end, and when it does, the Fed will have no choice but to literally buy back all the debt of the 80s, that is, to replace all of the formerly invested private money with newly manufactured fiat money, plus a great deal more to cover the interest. Then we will understand the meaning of inflation. On the other side of the coin, the Federal Reserve has the option of manufacturing money even if the federal government does not go deeper into debt. For example, the huge expansion of the money supply leading up to the stock market crash in 1929 occurred at a time when the national debt was being paid off. In every year from 1920 through 1930, federal revenue exceeded expenses, and there were relatively few government bonds being offered. The massive inflation of the money supply was made possible by converting commercial bank loans into reserves at the Fed's discount window and by the Fed's purchase of bankers' acceptances, which are commercial contracts for the purchase of goods. Now the options are even greater. The Monetary Control Act of 1980 has made it possible for the creature to monetize virtually any debt instrument, including IOUs from foreign governments. The apparent purpose of this legislation is to make it possible to bail out those governments which are having trouble paying the interest on their loans from American banks. When the Fed creates fiat American dollars to give foreign governments in exchange for their worthless bonds, the money path is slightly longer and more twisted, but the effect is similar to the purchase of U.S. Treasury bonds. The newly created dollars go to the foreign governments, then to the American banks where they become cash reserves. Finally, they flow back into the U.S. money pool, multiplied by 9, in the form of additional loans. The cost of the operation, once again, is borne by the American citizen through the loss of purchasing power. Expansion of the money supply, therefore, and the inflation that follows, no longer even require federal deficits. As long as someone is willing to borrow American dollars, the cartel will have the option of creating those dollars specifically to purchase their bonds, and by so doing, continue to expand the money supply. We must not forget, however, that one of the reasons the Fed was created in the first place was to make it possible for Congress to spend without the public knowing it was being taxed. Americans have shown an amazing indifference to this fleecing, explained undoubtedly by their lack of understanding of how the Mandrake mechanism works. Consequently, at the present time, this cozy contract between the banking cartel and the politicians is in little danger of being altered. As a practical matter, therefore, even though the Fed may create fiat money in exchange for commercial debt and for bonds of foreign governments, its major concern likely will be to continue supplying Congress. The implications of this fact are mind-boggling. Since our money supply, at present at least, is tied to the national debt, to pay off that debt would cause money to disappear. Even to seriously reduce it would cripple the economy. Therefore, as long as the Federal Reserve exists, America will be, must be, in debt. The purchase of bonds from other governments is accelerating in the present political climate of internationalism. Our own money supply increasingly is based upon their debt as well as ours, and they too will not be allowed to pay it off even if they are able. Taxes not even necessary. It is a sobering thought that the federal government now could operate, even at its current level of spending, without levying any taxes whatsoever. All it has to do is create the required money through the Federal Reserve System by monetizing its own bonds. In fact, most of the money it now spends is obtained that way. If the idea of eliminating the IRS sounds like good news, remember that the inflation that results from monetizing the debt is just as much a tax as any other. But because it is hidden and so few Americans understand how it works, it is more politically popular than a tax that is out in the open. Inflation can be likened to a game of Monopoly in which the game's banker has no limit to the amount of money he can distribute. With each throw of the dice, he reaches under the table and picks up another stack of those paper tokens which all the players must use as money. If the banker is also one of the players, and in our real world that is exactly the case, obviously he is going to end up owning all the property. But in the meantime, the increasing flood of money swirls out from the banker and engulfs the players. As the quantity of money becomes greater, the relative worth of each token becomes less, and the prices bid for the properties goes up. The game is called Monopoly for a reason. In the end, one person holds all the property, and everyone else is bankrupt. But what does it matter? It's only a game. Unfortunately, it is not a game in the real world. It is our livelihood, our food, our shelter. It does make a difference if there is only one winner, and it makes a big difference if that winner obtained his monopoly simply by manufacturing everyone's money. Fourth reason to abolish the system. Make no mistake about it, inflation is a tax. Furthermore, it is the most unfair tax of them all because it falls most heavily upon those who are thrifty, those on fixed incomes, and those in the middle and lower income brackets. The important point here is that this hidden tax would be impossible without fiat money. Fiat money in America is created solely as a result of the Federal Reserve System. Therefore, it is totally accurate to say that the Federal Reserve System generates our most unfair tax. Both the tax and the system that makes it possible should be abolished. The political scientists who authorized this process of monetizing the national debt and the monetary scientists who carry it out know that it is not true debt. It is not true debt because no one in Washington really expects to repay it, ever. The dual purpose of this magic show is simply to create free spending money for the politicians without the inconvenience of raising direct taxes, and also to generate a perpetual river of gold flowing into the banking cartel. The partnership is merely looking out for itself. Why, then, does the federal government bother with taxes at all? Why not just operate on monetized debt? The answer is twofold. First, if it did, people would begin to wonder about the source of the money, and that might cause them to wake up to the reality that inflation is a tax. Thus, open taxes at some level serve to perpetuate public ignorance, which is essential to the success of the scheme. The second reason is that taxes, particularly progressive taxes, are weapons by which elitist social planners can wage war on the middle class. A tool for social planning. The January 1946 issue of American Affairs carried an article written by Beardsley Rummel, who at that time was chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Rummel had devised the system of automatic withholding during World War II, so he was well qualified to speak on the nature and purpose of the federal income tax. His theme was spelled out in the title of his article: Taxes for Revenue Are Obsolete. In an introduction to the article, the magazine's editor summarized Rummel's views as follows. His thesis is that given control of a central banking system and an inconvertible currency, a currency not backed by gold, a sovereign national government is finally free of money worries and needs no longer levy taxes for the purpose of providing itself with revenue. All taxation, therefore, should be regarded from the point of view of social and economic consequences. Rummel explained that since the Federal Reserve now can create out of nothing all the money the government could ever want, there remain only two reasons to have taxes at all. The first of these is to combat a rise in the general level of prices. His argument was that when people have money in their pockets, they will spend it for goods and services, and this will bid up the prices. The solution, he says, is to take the money away from them through taxation and let the government spend it instead. This, too, will bid up prices, but Rummel chose not to go into that. He explained his theory this way. The dollars the government spends become purchasing power in the hands of the people who have received them. The dollars the government takes by taxes cannot be spent by the people, and therefore these dollars can no longer be used to acquire the things which are available for sale. Taxation is, therefore, an instrument of the first importance in the administration of any fiscal and monetary policy. Redistribution of wealth. The other purpose of taxation, according to Rummel, is to redistribute the wealth from one class of citizens to another. This must always be done in the name of social justice or equality, but the real objective is to override the free market and bring society under the control of the master planners. Rummel said, "The second principal purpose of federal taxes is to attain more equality of wealth and of income than would result from economic forces working alone. The taxes which are effective for this purpose are the progressive individual income tax, the progressive estate tax, and the gift tax. What these taxes should be depends on public policy with respect to the distribution of wealth and of income. These taxes should be defended and attacked in terms of their effect on the character of American life, not as revenue measures." As we have seen, Senator Nelson Aldrich was one of the creators of the Federal Reserve System. That is not surprising in light of the cartel nature of the system and the financial interests which he represented. Aldrich also was one of the prime sponsors of the federal income tax. The two creations work together as a far more delicate mechanism for control over the economic and social life of society than either one alone. In more recent years, there has been hopeful evidence that the master planners were about to abandon Rummel's blueprint. We have heard a great deal, both in Congress and at the Federal Reserve, about the